Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Thomas Ngoven. This is going to be a really interesting episode, I think, because we are here to discuss a fairly controversial movie, a movie that has been controversial throughout the years, Caligula, the movie that was famously kind of recut, redirected by Bob Guccione of Penthouse to... Make it more explicit back in, I think it was 1980 when this came out. Is that right?
Correct.
All right. And, but there's a new cut, that Tom worked on, that puts together, that basically recreates the original screenplay that was written by Gore Vidal. That's right. Do I have that correct?
That is correct. Yes.
Okay, but before we get to all that, Tom, I think you should fill folks in on the background here because I know about the movie Caligula. I don't want to assume everybody else does. So, what is the story of this movie? What was it that made it so controversial and has led to so many cuts being released over the years?
Oh wow! I hope this is a 3-hour episode because so what happened was, Gore Vidal wanted to tell a story about the corrupting influence of power and what happens when the people in power become separated from the needs of the people and illustrate that there's a cycle that occurs throughout history with this give and take of power. And so he wanted to create a film that would be titled Gore Vidal's Caligula to separate it from any other telling of the tale. And he and Franco Rossellini, who was the famous director Roberto Rossellini's nephew, couldn't get funding. But Gore and Bob were friendly. Bob Guccione had invested in movies like Chinatown and The Longest Yard, but he wanted to have more control creatively. And he saw this as an opportunity to make what he called a new kind of film, where it would be theoretically an unflinching view of what life was really like in Rome. So for Gore, that meant on kind of a socio-political level, and on Bob, it meant on a nudity and sex level. And he said in a press conference, he said, "This the movie is going to do for cinema what Citizen Kane did for films in its day." And they, of course, assembled some of the greatest actors in the world. They had Malcolm McDowell and Helen Mirren and Sir John Gielgud and Peter O'Toole. And then they needed the director that they wound up finding, and it was kind of before the casting. I'm a little out of order here, but... was a director named Tinto Brass, who was kind of an anarchist, and Bob thought was the right person to meld these two visions. The time between when they started filming and when the movie was released was 4 years. And the reason is because Gore Vidal and Tinto Brass and Bob Guccione wound up absolutely despising each other. And in the end, Gore sued to have his name removed from the film. Bob fired Tinto and threw the script out and edited together a version that was meant to just be a spectacle. And so what's happened is that for 40 plus years, Malcolm McDowell has been very vocal that he knows that they made a good movie. But what was released was a complete anomaly and a complete aberration and a betrayal of all the creatives that worked on the film. So that's the history. It's become kind of this white whale of cinema in that the version that everybody's heard about, that Variety magazine called a moral holocaust, that that Roger Ebert walked out of the theater was never the movie that anyone involved with it thought they were making. It was just a last-ditch effort of Bob Guccione, who then filmed additional sex scenes and edited it in with the performances of the film. So it makes no sense in any capacity because it doesn't follow a script. It doesn't. There are scenes in the old one where Malcolm will have a different costume in the same scene because it's two scenes that they edited together. It's just, it's a train wreck of cinema, but you have then this voice of people like Malcolm and Tinto Brass saying, this is not the movie that we made. So that's kind of where it is up until, you know, this new version that wound up, not to give away the ending, but we found all 96 hours of footage and edited together in the way that it was intended to be, as close as we could get to what it was intended to be, and then got invited to premiere at the Cannes Film Festival. So just a complete turnaround from what the movie was. If you think you know anything about Caligula, this is an entirely new creature.
Yeah. And we'll get to that in the ultimate cut here in a second, but my understanding is that the film was a fairly big success upon release, despite all of the meddling, despite the added sex scenes. I mean, like, I say this, you know, we live in a different age than 1980, but I was watching some of the original footage. I was like, oh, that is actually hardcore pornography in the film. That is not like, you know, late night HBO. That is something else.
Yeah, it was so. You know, everybody slows down when there's a wreck on the highway. And so what happened was no distributor would touch the movie back in 1980. And so Bob Guccione four-walled it and promoted the heck out of it. And everybody wanted to see the spectacle. And the more that people said it was terrible, it just made people say, I need to see this. And then it does have these elements where you can see that it swung for the fences. And there are glimmers of performances that are brilliant, and the sets are magnificent. So it is a very psychedelic experience to watch the 1980 version. And so there were theaters that had it running for a year. And ticket prices, Bob charged a premium. I think ticket prices in the day were normally $5, and he charged $7.50. So it made an enormous amount of money. It was very successful, except for, you know, the performers who were kind of embarrassed by this and wanted to ignore it. But yeah, the debacle.
And the writer and the director and yeah.
Well, the director, writer, composer, and editor all refused to be named in the credits. Yeah. Like that's a lot. That's four principal people.
Yeah, having watched a bit of the original cut, I can see why the editor wanted out, particularly compared to, you understand why. It's very interesting.
Well, so many people had their hands on it is why. It was like, by the end, it was just kind of like, imagine the worst job you've ever had where you know you're going to be fired the next day. And like, so it was just a lineage of people kind of cobbling things together.
Yeah, there is something also very funny to the image of Bob Guccione doing kind of a almost guerrilla filmmaking, coming into the sets that are already assembled after everybody has left for the day and being like, "All right, we're gonna do my thing now for a few hours." And
he knew by October that it wasn't gonna go the way he'd hoped. And so then they finished at the end of December. And then what happened is that about 2 weeks later, all the sets were still put together. And he flew a bunch of girls in from Penthouse and told them they were going to be in a James Bond movie. And then they showed up and he hired all the same extras, used all the same costumes. And then they filmed a bunch of purely you know, no ways around it, like purely explicit pornographic material with the intention that that was how he was going to get his money back. That's how he was going to rescue the film.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. All right. So let's fast forward to the Prisoner 20. When did you start working on this? When did you guys find the footage?
Oh, wow. It's so funny because time seems to move normally until I get this question. Then I realize it was 2019 that we really started, and 2020 when we announced it. It was an extraordinary amount of work. It had never been done before. And I found myself in a position of having to keep blazing new trails. And then also the Penthouse Archives had a majority of what was needed, but there was a lot missing. There were things that Bob Guccione's daughter had in her closet for the last few decades. So it became a detective search in locating everything that was needed in order to be able to do this appropriately.
I mean, that's wild. So the original negatives were in Penthouse's possession then, mostly, or were they scattered all around?
Okay. The thing that we had that was the backbone that was fantastic is that we did have the negatives for the movie itself. Mm-hmm. It was some extraneous research materials that I really needed to be able to do the job. It was a lot of audio things we were finding in other locations. Bob Guccione, both as an entity or as an individual and then Penthouse as an entity, had bankruptcies in years past. Mm-hmm. And so things had gone to collectors. The upside to that is that anyone that loves cinema deeply knows that collectors are very... enthusiastic. And so it wasn't like someone just bought this and didn't know what it was. It was something where I was able to it took probably a year to really figure out like who had what and how to get at them. And everybody was really helpful with it. So the bulk of it was in the singular archive. And the things that had scattered to the winds were pretty easy to pull together. It just took time.
How were the actual materials in terms of their preservation? How well preserved were they?
If you had found a body, it would be a horror movie because it was so perfectly preserved. It was like The Mummy. Everything was. All of the negatives had been in cold storage and were in pretty immaculate condition. The other materials, like things that were positive film prints and all of the magnetic audio tapes that were in storage, on the other hand, there's a thing that happens with a lot of these materials is that they get a thing called vinegar syndrome. And basically the outgassing is vinegar on a chemical level. Mm-hmm. There was one box I opened and I thought someone had slapped me in the face with a wet mop. It was so strong. You had to shut that right away. And so the fear going in was, what condition are these things going to be in? So we were really lucky that the things that had decayed, we were able to find alternate versions of. And the things that were irreplaceable, I can't express enough how miraculous it is that they were all immaculate, like really perfect.
Yeah. So let's talk about the actual reconstructing this film into showable shape for people, because you know it's not just finding the prints and and doing frame by frame reconstruction, right? You really. At least my understanding is you basically had to be editor on this, to edit together the footage, to put it all together, to get it in something approaching the original script by Gore Vidal. Is that right?
Yeah, I have a creative partner named Aaron Shapps, and we work together, and I kind of sit more in the director's seat, and he's more in the writer's seat. Between the two of us, we really were So the you know, when we made the first announcement, there's kind of two sides to this. One is the technical, which was a huge challenge in terms of, I thought we would need to put a disclaimer at the front saying, this is made from reconstituted fragments, like be gentle. But by the end, we didn't need to put that disclaimer on because of some of the advents in technology and things. We were able to use AI to repair some of the audio tapes, technology that Peter Jackson had developed for the Beatles documentary he did. So what we were able to do then on a technical level wouldn't have been possible even 5 years ago. Really, even when we started this project, a lot of the technology didn't exist. So that was one part of it. But then the part that was the really esoteric part that was in many ways harder because there wasn't a clear definition of success was they didn't film Gore Vidal's script. So it wasn't, you know, I thought, oh, we'll follow Gore Vidal's script. But then we started watching the footage. We started looking at the various iterations that the script went through. And what when Gore showed up on the set, he hated how garish and colorful it was. Danilo Donati was a set designer that was almost operatic in his delivery. It's such a beautiful, beautiful film. But he then went back to America and said, this looks like the lobby of the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach, and was mortified. And so then Tinto barred him from the set and said, if Gore doesn't stop talking, I'm going to publish his script. And I remember reading that and thinking, but it's Gore Vidal. It's got to be brilliant. But the thing that he didn't do was give Caligula a meaningful character arc. And that's something that Malcolm did. Malcolm brought in a playwright named Ted Whitehead, and together they really built the character of Caligula. I mean, Malcolm obviously was in his prime. He'd had the Lindsay Anderson films. He'd had A Clockwork Orange. He was absolutely, as a performer, ready to go. And so Tinto had a lot of humor and political anarchy that he wanted to work in. Malcolm had this character arc. Bob said, this will be the most historically accurate view of ancient Roman history. But then Danilo Donati, who famously never read the script, built a three-story elevator and a gigantic decapitation machine. So there's all of these people talking that are saying things that are completely different. So Malcolm's performance became our North Star. And it was almost like maybe watching a great jazz band or something. You could take the things that Bob had brought to the table, which are the people he hired, and you could take Tinto's sense of humor and the way that he really was trying to make it feel a little more contemporary in its story. It's not a traditional Roman tale, but then really the backbone is that Malcolm gives this incredibly operatic performance. And so the challenge that we had was trying to be respectful of everyone. I didn't want, there are people that are like, there should be a Tinto brass cut. And of course, you know, he's a director. Normally I would say yes, except he's 90. And maybe there should be the Bob Guccione cut. Well, we saw what that is. And I feel like it didn't serve anything except kind of weird spectacle. So I felt that my job was to be peacemaker. And how could you do something that the man who put the money up would feel honored what his intention was? How do you respect Gore as a writer? How do you respect Tinto as a director? And how do you respect the characters? And I'll sum up that answer by saying the thing that we found is that by looking at it like it's contemporary opera, or even more so, a fairy tale, that when Bob said he wanted it to be the most accurate depiction of Rome, and Gore was saying, I want to illustrate that there is a cycle to history. I think about when you go see modern opera and they try to give a different take on it. The minute that you walk into this movie, it's not our Rome. It's history adjacent. There are women in 3-foot platform heels. There's a gigantic decapitation machine. The whole thing is like a weird European comic from the 70s. So the way that we found the story was to say you know, if we look at it like an opera or a fairy tale, that's why the music in this one is way more present and important to the narrative than the earlier version, because I was looking at the idea that this is not traditional cinema. Everybody says we'd love to see something different. There's nothing more different than this. It's a very hard movie. It is not a movie that a lot of people will get on the first time. It is closer to opera or a fable than anything that you would see on your television.
Yeah, it really is interesting and worth checking out if you are, again, if you're interested in just the backstory of this film or whatever. The new release is out from Unobstructed View. I watched the Blu-ray DVD set that came out last month. There's a 4K coming out. It's hitting shelves either this week or next week. There was some. I feel like everybody is having
it's streaming
production
now
delays
too.
With. Yeah. And it's streaming now. Right, it's streaming
now as well. And it's not for everybody. It's definitely, it is a brutal, highly erotic. I mean, it is okay if this movie's not for you.
100%. And I kind of juxtaposed it with the original Guccione theatrical cut, saying, you know, that one has hardcore pornography in it, and it does, and this one doesn't as much, but there is still a ton of nudity and sex. It's you know, don't watch it with the kids in the room. It's one of those movies. Can we discuss a little bit the difference between 4K and Blu-ray and streaming and getting the product acceptable for all of those formats? Because I do feel like it is it's when you have that extra extra information there, it does make it harder, right, to make everything acceptable for everyone.
I'm not certain. I think that what it is that the problem usually is the source material. Meaning, if you have an old print that's a positive film print, you can't really scan it to get resolution above Blu-ray. If you have, and in many cases, this is a very common thing, only old files exist or things like that. So the advent of this 4K technology is challenging with older films. The thing that worked in our benefit is because we were starting from the negatives, we explicitly worked on the film the entire time for it to be finished in 4K. So basically, when people, you know, it's 4,000 lines of data, a Blu-ray is around 2,000, and a DVD is around 1,000. These are extremely general numbers. I'm sure people in the comments will clarify all of these details. But for the layperson, it's kind of like 1,000, 2,000, 4,000. Mm-hmm. So the exciting thing about a 4K release is that it theoretically, depending on how much compression gets used, theoretically someone on their screen, if they've got a 4K monitor that's set up correctly and doesn't have motion smoothing or things like that, that's a whole other thing, that they're seeing what I'm seeing. Like when I'm looking at the negatives and I'm seeing it up on my monitor, that there's no loss of resolution. So that's it's hard for me when I see it on like a computer screen where it's like on, you know, a YouTube clip or something, because, you know, 75% of the information is missing. Like I'm used to really being able to experience all that. So the advantage to 4K, and I think it might be streaming in 4K, I don't know. But yeah, it's beautiful in any capacity. But the higher the resolution, obviously the better.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, no, it does. And I'm always I'm a known partisan on this podcast for physical media and actually having the thing, because even if you stream something in 4K, there's always compression and loss, and it
I would imagine that I don't stream in 4K personally, I would feel like that's, I'm the same as you. I'll watch it on a disc when I do that. That's why I don't know about the streaming. It seems like that's a harder way to experience it than a good player and an appropriately set up television. That's the thing.
Yes,
when people set the sharpening and everything, it looks like a, you know, telenovela or something like that. It's not like a soap opera.
Yeah. I am also a big believer on this podcast of destroying motion smoothing. Just get rid of it entirely.
But thank you. You know,
that's an argument for another day.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Okay, yeah, so like this is a really interesting movie. It's got a great cast. It's got, as you like you mentioned, it's got Malcolm McDowell, it's got Helen Mirren, it's got Peter O'Toole. Malcolm McDowell's still around. He's still acting. What are his thoughts on this new Ultimate Cut?
When I first got the job, the very first person I emailed was Tinto Brass. And then the second person was Malcolm's manager, and then the third was Helen's manager. And over the first year of me trying hard to contact people associated with the film in any capacity, I didn't understand why I was at best ignored and at worst yelled at. And then as I got into it, it was such a traumatic experience for everybody who was involved that nobody wanted to come near anything involving Caligula. And if you mentioned it, it became an opportunity to vent about how terrible this situation or that situation was. And so I then stopped trying to contact people like Tinto or Malcolm or Helen. I would send updates. I would, you know, try to let their managers know what was going on out of respect, but I was very clear that no one was going to return my calls. And after it played at Cannes, you know, kind of the short version of the story is that a mutual friend messaged me and said, "Hey, Malcolm would like your phone number. Is it okay if I give it to him?" And I was as stunned as I was in that last, you know, couple seconds there. What do you say? Of course. Yes, of course, of course, of course. So I send the number it's a weird thing to then 2 minutes later have your phone ring and pick it up and hear that voice. Like I can't, you know, there aren't many voices in the world of cinema that you hear it and you're looking at your phone like, am I listening to a video? It's so powerful and so iconic. And he said, "Tom, I'm sorry that I didn't call you sooner." And I was like, what's going on? And he said, "I just watched your version of the film and I'm completely floored. And I had forgotten what I had done back then." And he said, "I was really moved." He's like, "I need time to process it, but whatever you need, I'm here for you. This is the movie that I thought we were making." And then over the months that followed, he went with me to the American premieres and has just been an extraordinary human being. And something I've said multiple times is, like, they say don't meet your idols, but I'm telling you, if your idol is Malcolm McDowell, you're pretty safe. Like, as much as he plays the heavy in these movies, I've had the blessing and opportunity to see him around his kids. And that's just who he is. He's been like a dad to me. He's been so, so wonderful and really, really nurturing and supportive. And so I was really happy. People had asked me for a long time, what did Helen see it? What did she think? And I knew she had seen it, but she hadn't commented publicly, so I couldn't say anything. And maybe 3 weeks ago now, she was on the BBC with Mark Kermode and then commented favorably about the film, about it being the movie they thought they were making. And so the good news for me at this point is that it's so clearly not a movie for everyone, but I did feel a really, really important affinity for these creative people who really got steamrolled in the machine of business. You know, it seems like in a perfect world, those things would work in harmony, but that so rarely happens. And so the fact that for, you know, Helen Mirren in the old version is only on screen for 8 or 9 minutes. Mm-hmm. And in the new version, she's in for nearly an hour. So the fact that there was so much weight, she was kind of a magpie in the 1980 version. But in the new one, she's visibly one of the main characters.
Yeah.
And the thought that, and specifically those two, because they have the biggest expansion, the thought that it could have happened very, very easily, that the world would never know that they'd made this movie and that what would have been left was just this weird anomaly. I do feel like it's an enormous victory for creativity. It's an enormous victory for art, for cinema. You know, even now, I look at so much of what is coming into theaters doesn't completely speak to me. I do enjoy a lot of it. I'm not going to lie. But when I think about what I look for in literature or music, there is a much wider gamut. It's not shoved into kind of the same narrow tunnel that we get with cinema. And so whether it's Gore Vidal or Bob Guccione or Tinto Brass, and especially Malcolm McDowell and Helen Mirren, I think that I like the idea that cinema, that it's okay for something to not be for everyone. And I also like the idea for it to be okay that this is a movie that really, nobody could get it on the first pass. And I'm saying that as someone that's seen it dozens of times and obviously built it. But on the surface level, it's a story about Rome and power. And then you get deeper and it's into these very spiritual and metaphysical ideas about identity and our own cycles. And the idea that this undisciplined person lives in terror, then gets power, and it kind of breaks his system and he becomes the things that he fears. And then at the end starts to look at himself as a character in that lineage. And to me, that speaks to community. Like, not to get, you know, off on a political tangent, but the idea that something that's really important to me that I feel is lost is that idea that, like, man, I used to have friends all over the spectrum. And it was like, but your community was what was so important. It wasn't the bloodbath that it's become. And so I feel like part of Caligula's journey in this movie is he starts to view himself as having become the thing that he despised and then transcending that. All of this is really clearly laid out. It's the hero's journey. Gore knew these things. This is all stuff that, and in the end, recognizing that there's a part in the end that isn't in the original. This doesn't spoil it. People know what happened to Caligula in history.
Yeah.
But there's a part in the movie where he's in the Senate. And after polarizing everything, like, so they're united, then he's polarizing, like, all of this huge long thing. He starts touching the symbols of Rome and he starts to cry. And what he realizes in that moment is that the empire is bigger than him. It's bigger than a man. It's bigger than one person and their mundane desires, carnal or political or anything. And that transcendence, to me, is what makes this a fable. It's what makes it a cautionary tale that I think it's really hard for people to get on the first viewing. So all of these things that I'm saying, like, you know, I feel like that's really what's important about this movie, is that when people come out and they're like, oh, I like it or I didn't like it, it's like, how often do you read a really great book and then just, you know, give your thoughts really quickly? Like, you need to sit with things. And we do that with books. We do that with literature. We do that with music. But we don't do that with film. We treat it like it's disposable. And I personally would love to see that change more. And I'm just hoping on some level that this is at least just a tiny pinky on the scale of starting to look at cinema as an art form again and not content.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely, look, again, this is it's a fascinating film to kind of look at and consider. There's a joke that I see on Twitter sometimes where a guy in glasses, kind of like mine, says, you know, film editing is the only art unique to cinema. And I'm like, well, okay, that's funny, but it's also true, kind of. It's, you know, that is like putting together a story in that specific way is unique to the idea of movies as a piece of storytelling. And this is a really good illustration of that, I think. In addition to the fact that you added, you know, there's tons of lost footage and it's all put back together. So I'm rambling now. I'll stop. That was everything.
No, I love it though, because it could have gone a million different ways. Like, that's one thing that Malcolm was really clear with, because I was being very arm's length about it. And he kept saying, no, this is your movie. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, Tinto would have done something different. He's like, I think Tinto would love what you have done. He's like, but there's a style to it. And there's an opinion to it that is very you. He's like, and I love it. And he, you know, texted me once, God, could you imagine if this version had come out in 1980? Like, just what it would have done for cinema, for his career. I mean, who knows? But it's meant to be very of 1980. I'll say that. Whereas in 1980, they were trying to make it feel like a 50s film. Yeah. That's a whole other long tangent. Yeah. Well, I can get on. But we did try, I told the composer, you can use anything as long as the serial number is before 1980. We tried to push it right up to be like a world-changing cinematic event in 1980. Mm-hmm. We weren't trying to take it past that.
Yeah.
But again, that's a whole other...
Well, I want to ask one. I want to ask one question that's slightly. We're going to get slightly in the weeds here, just about the credits on the film itself. Mm-hmm. Because if you watch the movie, you'll notice in the opening credits, where you would usually have a written by credit, I think the credit is adapted from a screenplay by Gore Vidal. And then there's instead of a directed by credit, there's a principal photography by Tinto Brass. Credit, these are distinctions that your average person may see and not really think about, but they are, I'm guessing, probably very specific legal and union mandated credits. What was the story there?
It's legal. So Gore hated what Malcolm and Tinto and Ted were doing to his script. He said, they're taking my scenes, but they're flipping them on their heads. And he said, this is no longer Gore Vidal's Caligula. And he sued to get his name removed from the title. And he said, and you cannot claim this is my script. You can say whatever it is, you know, adapted from a screenplay by. He's like, but it's not my script. So that's Gore. Then with Tinto, same thing. When Bob fired him, he said, part of my process is the editing. And if I'm not editing it, it's not my film. And so he sued, and he was actually successful in gaining the rights to the film in Italy. So then Bob smuggled the film out of Italy to be able to put it into jurisdictions where he could gain control. So the way that fell out, though, in terms of what you're commenting on is that the legal settlement with Tinto is that he can't be credited as director. Just principal photography by. Because he's like, I filmed it. He's like, I was there for principal photography, but I didn't direct this. This is not my movie. And then those credits, now the editor and composer credits from 1980 don't carry over, but that's why those two credits had to be worded that way. It was very funny at the Cannes Film Festival. They didn't have a way to put a name that wasn't director. It wound up being a huge deal that they had to go into their coding or something and shift it to say principal photography by, because they just had never had it happen before.
Well, but
the French are just illegal.
The French are very strict on the legalese dealing with directors. But again, that is a
yeah. I mean, you know, and you know, when people have said, "Oh, and Tinto threatened to sue," it's like he didn't threaten to sue. He was complaining because things were putting up directed by Tinto Brass, because they just, you know, and he should be upset about that. Like, you know, it's not what he wanted to do. And I think that, yeah, people should be, it happens all the time where I'll see somewhere that it says directed by, and I'll have to email them and say, hey, you got to change that. And obviously the distributors should be doing that as well, but you know, I mean, it's just being respectful of the wishes of this artist.
Yeah, yeah. All right, that was everything I wanted to ask about Caligula, the ultimate cut, and everything that went into that. Tom, is there anything...
Everything you wanted to know and more.
we could keep going. But I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything folks should know about the movie or restoring it or anything. What should we have discussed that we did not?
I mean, you know, for me personally, when I came into this movie, I had a perception of what I thought it was going to be. And it was I recognize now that they were all variants of the 1980 version. And it took me a long time to really understand that it's kind of like, you know, it's just mentally, it's like having a house with a bad foundation. That no matter how much you put additions onto it or whatever, like you're still, it's going to fall apart. And so when I looked at the movie as being that what we were doing, this really came after Malcolm was giving me, you know, his thoughts. The 1980 version has to be purely artistically, I'm not talking historically, artistically it has to be discarded as an aberration. If I go into a vault and I take some master tapes from The Who and I play them backwards and start banging pots and pans and say, this is a Who album, it's not a Who album. And even if people then start to look at it that way, to look at the master tapes then being released, if you try to compare it to this aberration, like the New York Times wrote a review and said, I don't like this version of Caligula. Caligula is supposed to be chaotic and confusing. And I thought, how could you miss the point? The point is that what was released in 1980, no one would take credit for. And to say, but that's the point of the art, is it disregards everyone who worked on it. And so I think that the biggest thing that I would just say is that the most positive reviews that I've heard are from people that never saw the old one, that came into this as a new movie and they're like, this is mind-blowing. And if you settle in and you go for this ride, it's an extraordinary experience. It's the people that have nostalgia for the old one that have had the biggest challenge. So I guess the biggest thing is just, as I kind of was saying earlier, you know, this is an opportunity to view cinema in a really powerfully artistic way. It's not an easy movie by any stretch of the imagination. And I would say that if people, whether you love it or hate it, I would say that this is not just me trying to pitch it, but I would say legitimately, it is a movie worth watching again to see the way the story sits once you start to get into it, where you can understand it in a wheel-like fashion. And in my experience, the best opera, the best literature, I never got it the first time. And I think that's just kind of the thing is, you know, there's all of this expectation, oh, it's just this crazy Roman movie. And then it's like, but it's not. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm kind of babbling myself, but I think, you know, it's just, there's no precedent for this. And it's an opportunity for anyone who loves storytelling and creativity and pushing boundaries and self-examination, all of that, you know, intellectual discourse. There's a lot here to chew. And I would hope that people would at least be passionate enough about watching what Malcolm and Helen built to invest some time in it and just see where it takes you, see what the experience is. It's not a normal film. It's not like anything else.
Yeah. No, I mean that, and again, it is fascinating just on a pure art of editing level to watch this compared to previous cuts. So I at the very least, that is something to think about as you're just weighing whether or not you want to get it on VOD or pick it up on Blu-ray. A new 4K is hitting shelves soon.
I mean, that is a good argument for the. It is a good argument for the Blu-ray to be able to revisit it. I did a commentary track on there. I did two commentary tracks that I hope are interesting. And
yeah,
but yeah, I could talk for hours, man. I'm sorry. I'm a rambler.
No, it's good. Tom, thanks for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Oh my God. Thank you so much. This was a unique pleasure. It was really great. I liked it a lot.
Good, good. Once again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.